Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher are joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, from podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight because I'm in Sweden, and me, Samuel Mann. I'm at BTH with Dr. Henrik Nye. We're sitting in his office. Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to have you.
Where did you grow up?
About 100 kilometers to the west of here, south of Sweden. Small town near a big lake, nice place to grow up.
Does sound nice.
Yeah.
What's the reason for that town existing?
That used to be, there was a big factory, and they started to build housing for the workers. And I think it came from that. And then it's also, and now it's a commuting town also. Some bigger places around, and people live in this place.
And what did you want to be when you grew up?
I had different ideas. Sometime I wanted to be a cop, like every other kid. And Indian or something, but then I started being more realistic. And sustainability was something that came along gradually, but maybe from the age of 12 or something, I started to realize that there's something seriously wrong with the world and I wanted to do something about it.
Do you think every kid thinks that?
I think so, in some ways, but I mean, we're not always reflecting as much. And I know that I have a son myself. He's 7. He's already maybe probably I influence him. But
you'd hope so.
I think so. But I think it's quite different when. But I think we all have those thoughts. And maybe the question is how. What do we do with them? Do we continue on that path, or are we? Because sometimes you get quite depressed when you realize there's so many things, and when should I take responsibility for this? Or how can I do something?
Yeah. It's interesting that that thought happens earlier than thinking about, I want a nice place for my kids to grow up, my grandchildren. You're probably not thinking of that when you're 12.
No.
I wonder why some people manage to hold on to it and others don't.
Yeah.
What did you choose to study?
When I took high school first, and then I focused on engineering and science, which was easy for me because it was broad and it was giving all the options. And then after that, it was more difficult. So for university, I realized I wanted to do sustainability, but I was just 1 or 2 years too early because all of those exploded a few years later. So I started with chemical engineering. And then I started to direct that towards sustainability as much as I could. So, yeah, it went quite well.
Did you find much sustainability in chemical engineering when you got there?
It was not framed as sustainability. I mean, a lot of the topics are there, but it's more or less fragmented. Like, if you know what you're doing, you can use that to help you move towards sustainability. But it was not put together as a concise package that with this you can work with sustainability. So I tried to do that myself, and I think I ended up quite well with some other extra courses and another program on top towards environmental economics.
You're the third person that I've spoken to today that has told me almost identical story of going and studying engineering and doing ecology or something on the sly.
Yeah.
Is that I'm not talking to a general sample of engineers.
No.
But is it a common thing that people do?
Most of the people you talked to today probably were my age or older. So I think there was a big change happening mid-90s in Sweden when a lot of new environmental educations came. So maybe I think end of the 90s you could start an engineering education that was tailored towards sustainability all from start. And had I started then, I would have taken that education without a blink. But I had to make it myself instead.
Do you think you're stronger, though, for having background in chemical
engineering?
In
some ways, not only from the experience of having those topics, but also from wrestling with what I want to do more, because I wasn't totally in focus with what I wanted to do. But I think so.
So what did you study in particular as you went through?
Chemical engineering.
Yeah, did you do a master's?
Yeah, I did a master's, and I focused on, we could make, after 3 years, we could take a major, and I majored towards what we call chemical engineering, or it doesn't sound very specific, but it's about how you can move into a factory, and basically, analyzing, finding problems, solving them. And it turns out that all chemical engineering factories are quite simple. They have just 5 or 6 different types of processes. So if you understand those, then you can understand almost any factory, which is quite cool. So I focus on that with the aim of directing it towards sustainability and solving sustainability problems in factories and so on.
By adding another process to that set of processes, or by tweaking each of the existing processes?
To begin with, tweaking the existing processes. I mean, energy conservation is one topic that we focus on, to use resources effectively and efficiently. And I mean, we have a lot of waste in factories, both in terms of physical materials that are not used as they could be, and energy is not used as it could be. Sometimes you're heating one part of the factory and you're cooling the other part. So actually you could use the heat you extract from the cooling to heat the other part if you just connect them. That's something we did, for example.
Those things always seem to me, people say those things, and it seems so obvious. Why are people not doing that anyway?
I mean, one thing is that they are under a pressure daily that they need to deliver the main product. And often these energy costs are not so big on the final margin. And also that it's practically difficult sometimes, because it might be an old factory that has been added on gradually. And if you want to connect those two things, you need to have a physical pipeline across the whole factory or something. So it's, if you build it from scratch, it's much easier. If you start something new, then you can do it very optimized. But
that's kind of the story of our working lives, though, isn't it? We're trying to fix broken systems.
Yeah. So it rarely happens that you have the chance to build something from scratch. Basically.
And then your PhD?
Yeah, I went out in industry for 4 years because I had done some extra time in university and I thought wanted to work. And about 4 years later, I felt it was time to go back again. And then I had done some chemical engineering in industry, and I was responsible for waste management at the chemical factory for a few years. And then I realized I wanted to be able to influence more than just one company, and maybe also have the chance to really stretch my boundaries on what I could do. Like, what if I had the chance to do things as good as I could? What would that be? And then I realized suddenly I need to go to university to be able to do that. Because you always do good enough in industry, they won't survive if they do it too advanced, because then they can't pay back the investment. So, yeah, that was the story. I went back. I found Carl-Henrik Robert and Göran Broman through a conference. I found Carl-Henrik, and then he told me about this spot here as a PhD student, and a few months later I was here. So, and I had actually, he was my idol for many years, Carl-Henrik, since I had realized he started the natural step. But I didn't really know about the research part of that until I met with him, and that was very interesting. So here I went.
So in detail, your PhD?
My PhD...
In a once-over likely kind of detail.
Yeah, like in an elevated pitch.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's about a toolbox for strategic sustainability work in companies. So how can a company practically integrate sustainability in the strategic product thinking and so on? And I did several different developments of existing tools, and I sort of started to test them with industry and bringing them together, suggesting how to build on from that. And right now I'm actually working with a follow-up from that. I'm using my PhD methods to look into how electric vehicles could be expanded and how you combine efforts from different actors and so on. Not one actor can do this alone.
So what are some of the things in the toolbox?
We have something called life cycle assessment, which is about following the resource flows from nature and like the bedrock. When those resources are gathered, we put them into society, we do things with them, there are some emissions, there is some energy use, and finally it ends up often, unfortunately, in a dump or somewhere looking like a dump. We want them to be recyclable and to be recycled in society, but this life cycle assessment is assessing how flows are going through society. And I took that and adapted that with a more strategic outlook, with the work around strategic sustainability that we have here at VTH. So rather than just looking at the systems as they are, we also started to think about principles for sustainability. How could these systems be assessed from principles of sustainability?
So we heard a few weeks ago from Joran Broman about those principles. So, but can you just give us a quick reminder of those principles?
The idea with them is that rather than addressing all the issues as they come one by one, which is a nightmare, there's so many things going on and you don't get an overview, we divided all the sustainability issues into, you could say, big segments or areas under one principle each. So rather than looking at all the different types of emissions from the Earth's crust, we just say emissions from the Earth's crust, including carbon dioxide, cadmium in the kidneys and everything, they should not be allowed to increase in the system systematically, because then we have problems sometime or late, now or later. So already the process of increasing concentrations is a problem before you know what consequences they give. So you can get ahead. You can just look at where concentrations increase, and then you can start to address that. And then there are three other principles. One about chemicals, which are combinations of substances from the Earth's crust. Those are chemicals. And they can be even worse sometimes, because maybe nature didn't even see them before. And then there are, the third one is about extracting other ways to break down natural systems and covering them with asphalt and other types of destruction of natural systems. And the fourth one is about social sustainability, because even if we address all the ecological sustainability issues and we don't address social issues, then people will not deal with this in a good way. So we need to be happy and sustainable at the same time.
So a couple of questions arise. One of them is about timescales, and the other one is how you apply that to life cycles. So let's do the timescales. And what I mean by timescales is, if you're saying it doesn't really matter that we don't know what the consequences are, just the fact that it's accumulating is by definition bad. How easy is it to engage people in the fact that this thing might be bad sometime in the future, we don't know when or why?
That's an issue, I guess. It's easier to graphically describe something happening right now, showing some dying animals or something, of course. But we have a cooperation with another research group working on planetary boundaries. Johan Rockström is quite famous out of Stockholm Environmental Institute. And that's an easy, that's a quite neat combination, because they have worked on the long-term operating space of human society along about 10 different types of indicators. So there you have sort of the time scale in a way, because if they set up the boundary, we have the processes that increase concentrations. They have set up the boundaries for how far that process can go. So in combination, we work like that. Yeah. So companies like the fact that we're not telling them what they should do, rather giving them tools to assess their own problems and giving deciding on a conscious level what risks they are willing to take. If they understand this, they understand that as long as they are acting in an unsustainable way, they are taking a risk. But it takes some while before they realize that sometimes.
Can you really manage to do that? Can you really manage to not say, that's bad, it's bad, don't do that? How hard is it to not come in with some value statements?
It is hard sometimes, of course. And it depends on who you're working with, I guess. If you're working with someone who is obviously... It's not likely that you are working with someone who is doing totally unsustainable business. They're probably not interested to talk to you. But if you're working with someone who's trying to do something, trying to improve, I think it's sometimes counterproductive to be too dogmatic or too... I never tone down the science or the consequences of something, but I'm trying not to tell them how they should run their business.
Can you tell? How do you tell? If they get you in and you're going to meet someone important,
yeah,
and they say, our business is trying to transform, how do you tell if they really mean it or if it's the marketing people have got to them and they're going for a bit of greenwash?
Of course, that's sometimes not possible. You tell by what is happening, in a way. Does it take effect in the core business, or is it just some soup? Are you coming back a year later and they have just started to recycle in the offices rather than looking at the main process? I mean, then that's a sign that they're not really buying it. But I guess you cannot know, in the beginning, probably.
Okay, and the nice and slowly for me, if we take a life cycle analysis assessment, which is already kind of a holistic,
yeah,
bigger than just the thing you've got in front of you.
Yeah.
What do you gain by adding this strategic bit to it?
The nature of something that is holistic and big is that it sometimes gets so big and blurry that you don't know where to look, you don't know where to focus. And what we try to do is that in a life cycle assessment, you have a scoping phase in the beginning where you decide what to look at, what to go deeper into. You could say that I have added a scoping device to the life cycle assessment. That before determining all the system boundaries of the life cycle assessment, what to look at and what to not look at, we make an overview assessment of against the principles of sustainability, so that you can see, just by knowing that the fact that you are looking for substances from the Earth's crust and you know the business you're in, if it's cell phones or something, then you can easily start to think about, are there any substances in the cell phone from the Earth's crust, for example. So it's like an early scoping stage. And the idea of that is to keep track and not get lost into all the details. And then you can come back after doing some life cycle assessment, come back again to the scoping and say, yeah, maybe we're not totally right. Maybe we should tweak it a little bit. So it's like an iterative process as well. And we're actually using this now for electric vehicles. We did a study on electric buses, and we did compared 7 different types of buses and came up with electric buses being the cheapest, actually 20% cheaper than diesel buses over a 10-year period. And that in itself was a very interesting result. So, but we use this study, life cycle assessment, for environmental issues and for costs also. So we followed costs and environmental emissions throughout the processes.
Let's go for another one. Yeah. We'll talk about green charge but in a minute. But I'm fascinated by these tools and how you're adding value to those existing tools by adding this strategic thing. So have you got another example of a tool that you've extended?
Yeah, because if you look at life cycle assessment as some kind of picture you take on a system at any given, it's static by nature. Like you get a picture of how flows are right now in a system, what are the emissions and so on. That's static. But if you want to become dynamic and say, which is the nature of strategy in a way, and scenarios, then you should come into like a movie sequence. What happens in this system if you start to tweak it and you run time? That's what we call system dynamics in a way. And that's what I also did. That was my final tool in the thesis. And so based on life cycle assessment and system dynamics and this strategic perspective, I tried to make, first of all, goals where we wanted to go to reach more towards sustainability, and then tweak the system to see if different scenarios could take us towards that goal. So, and that is it's difficult to do, of course, because when you make system dynamics, anyone who has done that knows that it can easily become a model that is so complex that you don't understand what's going on. So that's the challenge, basically, to do something that is complicated or complex enough to address reality in a good way, but not so complex that you don't understand what's going on. So I guess that's why no one has done that to a very successful degree yet, because it's very difficult. There are many people working with system dynamics in a good way, but I think no one has been able to make an operational tool that integrates strategic sustainability with life cycle assessment and system dynamics, which is what I'm trying to do.
And even fewer that would include the last one, in particular the social one, into that. I imagine that most of the people doing that sort of systems type analysis will be mostly doing it on a business physical process.
Yeah, that's true.
You throw participation into that mix, empowerment and all those sorts of things.
Mm. Yeah.
That gets even more complicated.
Yeah, and I mean, we have a social sustainability side here in our department, and we do some research developing principles for that as well. And then we try to build that into modeling as well. But it is more difficult because, of course, human systems are not as straightforward as chemical systems.
So that leads nicely to the green charge then. So you tell me what green charge is, and then I'll ask the question that's burning in my head.
Yeah, green charge is right now the biggest demonstration and research project for electric vehicles in Sweden. And it is run out of BTH, and I started it together with some colleagues in different organizations a few years ago. And it's a very interesting experience. And in it, we combine practical demonstrations of electric vehicles and the systems surrounding it with strategic sustainability research.
So here's the question that jumped in my head. Is it a technical problem or is it a social problem?
What?
If we take a backcasting approach, okay, here's my vision that in 2030, the majority of personal transport is in electric. Electric vehicles.
Or, not necessarily electric, it could be other, but sustainable vehicles.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is that a technical problem or a societal problem?
I mean, the technology we need is more or less here. So I think it's more of a socio-economical problem. Like, how can you mobilize the necessary actors to act in a coordinated way to make this possible? And affordable as well, because of course you can always say what should be done sustainably, but if companies doing it will run bankrupt before they go there, then little is won. So we try to divide it in two steps. First, we make a wishing list of things we want to do. And then when we have that, then we start to prioritize based on the short-term economics. So that you would try to build on with such things that will both give you money now and prepare for coming steps. We call it sometimes flexible platforms that you can step on to get to the next one or to the next one.
Somebody pointed out, and I was talking to a year or so ago, that the transition from 80% horses to 80% cars was remarkably quick, like 7 years or something.
Yeah. I've heard something similar, that someone said it should take 1,000 days to transition into a new transport paradigm. And someone related to Tesla or looked at the Tesla case and saying that sometime soon there will be a very quick transition towards electric vehicles and so on. So I've heard something similar, yes.
So how far away do you think we are? Have we started the 1,000 days yet?
No, probably not. But I think, there is a process of decreasing the cost for batteries now. I think it's halving by every 5 years. In 5 years, half the price for the same battery capacity, which is. And we did calculations now that in Sweden, with some subsidies and relatively low energy prices, already now, in some cases, it's profitable to buy electric vehicles if you have them for 3 or more years. So in Norway, much more so, because they have hugely more subsidies than we have, even Denmark and so on. But short answer, not yet, but within 5 years, I think a lot will happen. I think there will be a lot happening, and probably within 5 years.
What do you think it's going to take to start the clock ticking on that 1,000 days? I'm thinking that the plug-in Outlander, Mitsubishi Outlander, is quite a big step, because that's an ordinary car.
Yeah. With a hook, what is it called? What do you call that? Where you can add a cart to something. The thing you
can carry. Toga.
Yeah.
For pulling a trailer.
Yeah. Mm. That is something people have asked about for many years now. Can we have an electric car with the capacity to have another trailer or something? And now we have. So that's a big thing, yes.
Of course, electric cars don't solve the energy problem. They just slightly more efficient. It means you can produce the energy in one go rather than have that driving around the roads.
They're quite a lot more effective. I mean, almost like one-third, one-fourth of the energy used by a fossil. But still, it's not the only thing needed to deal with the sustainability issues, of course. But you were aiming at something, I guess. Or I agree that it's helping, but it's not the only thing needed. I mean, we need to look at our transport habits, building societies that don't make us need so many transports. Maybe focusing workplaces and housing. And more close to each other so that you don't need to travel so much and so on.
So what are the goals of the Green Charge project?
If I say only one thing, it's to have a regional roadmap for Southeast Sweden for how electric vehicles can be part of our national vision of fossil-free transports 2030. So, to make it short, we are doing these practical experiments and research investigations to be able to build a roadmap for the region.
By when? 2040?
2030.
2030. Just took 10 years off. Hope you didn't mind.
15.
Yes, 15 years from now. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, sorry. Now I get you.
just make it a bit harder. Let's make it 20, shall we?
Yeah.
Who set that date?
The Swedish government did. I think it was four or five years ago.
Because it sounded good, or because it's a useful target date, or it's a date that somebody thought it would be possible by, or?
I think, unfortunately, that when it was set, it was not totally thought through, because they even added an investigation to that was delivered last year about what it means and what the possible roads towards that goal could be and so on. And yeah, it was a very strong statement, of course, but and I think it's possible. But I don't think it's at all common knowledge of what would be required to make it possible. Because it's quite a lot to change the current situation to that situation.
So what are the barriers on that road, the roadmap?
I mean, we're looking at status quo is a big barrier. Like a lot of companies and societal functions are focused on the current system based on oil and so on, and we even have taxes that are funding a big part of society based on our gasoline prices. I mean, we have quite a lot of that in Sweden.
Yeah, a fuel tax.
Yeah, it's almost as big as the Swedish defense, the money coming from the fuel tax. So then it's not easy either for the state or for the companies to quickly switch. But still, what is good is that if there is a big shift and suddenly some people like Tesla and other companies start to make money in the new paradigm, at some point everybody needs to move in that direction, because then otherwise they will lose. So as long as there are a few good examples and that really move forward and succeed, I think it will probably be possible to quite quick switch later on. But of course, those who don't act proactively might really lose on the transition. So that's of course a big problem. And I think talking about barriers, it's also about knowledge to begin with for politicians. How can they sort between all the lobbying happening and all the science it's sometimes difficult to distinguish between opinions from some interest groups and facts, more fact-like, scientifically based things. So I think a lot of knowledge is needed, and a lot of different actors need to find their positions and their contribution to this happens.
So how is this work being informed by the strategic sustainable, got those words in the wrong order, framework?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that framework does is that it raises a few principles as some kind of common guiding theme for any actor. Actually, it's built at such a high level that anyone acting in society could start to, according to principle one, identify how they contribute to increasing concentration of substances from the Earth's crust. And that means if we have common goals, it's easier to cooperate and find your particular contribution to reach that goal. And we also have a tradition of experience for more than 20 years to make different work with particular companies, but also with sectors with where you have different types of actors working together. So that is needed in this transition.
Do, as a consumer, are you talking about consumers being able to identify like these principles? Or is this something that is a system change, that it's not something we expect people to be making conscious decisions about?
I think they could. I mean, we even had the natural step that is, BTH core partner in this, They have even done courses with kids, young school age, and around ages 7 to 10 or something, where they have started to work with this. And I think you probably need to change the wording slightly, which is a bit risky because sometimes that loses its strictness. But if you understand, grasp the essentials of each of these principles, I think it's really helpful even in private life. There's a lot of pedagogy needed, and we have a master's program here, and we try to teach students from different disciplines all over the world. And I think we succeeded quite well to build that education to a big reputation and so on. But it's building a network too. The idea is to make people having a shared language from different places and different positions so that we can work together.
In terms of that education, you mentioned people from different disciplines. Which are the easiest disciplines to teach? Do some disciplines like just
to teach sustainability too?
Yeah.
I mean, engineers are often good in the way that they understand systems and flows, and you could say what has been up to this date the strongest part of this strategic framework is the environmental side. And the social sustainability side is more difficult in a way. But engineers grasp the physical side quite and the environmental side more easily, I think. Because they're used to making system boundaries, they're used to they even know about those systems already.
And it's reducing everything down to processes and system models.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is, of course, a problem with people who are not accustomed to that, and then it's rather a barrier.
So I was going to say, who is it harder to teach it to?
Yeah. And probably people who are more intuitively oriented than logically oriented, regardless of what discipline they are in. Social science is often not as strong in this area. And they have different, sometimes social science is more about understanding a system, looking at it, understanding it. That's fine, but here it's sometimes difficult to make this cross-disciplinary leap. But I would also want to say that the social side of sustainability is sometimes neglected by the engineers. So it's good if we can bring together different disciplines so that we together can cover the whole sustainability concept better.
When you're reducing things down to processes, is there a common currency, and is that currency money?
I don't think we say that there's a common currency. You could, of course, try to value everything in money, but and sometimes people say, okay, common currency like exergy or some energy unit. Everything should be energy or something, but then you miss some things that cannot be converted into that. The quality of the system is not always converted into money or energy. It's like need fulfillment and so on. I would say no, not money as such. But of course, you can come quite far with value-oriented, if you don't say money, but value, maybe that's better. Or need fulfillment, which money can sometimes be an indicator of, but not always. Sometimes it's the opposite. Yeah.
Because you've also studied environmental and ecological economics.
And even philosophy.
What's the difference between environmental and ecological economics?
Well, not everyone would make that distinction, but the distinction that if you say normal economics, or which sometimes called neoclassical, or what we teach normally at universities, then basically everything should be solved with supply and demand, and keeping the market clean from interventions and so on. And then that's the ideal market. If you run out of resources, they start to become more expensive, and then you that would stop further use of them. That's the classical economists would say that. Environmental economics says that, well, fair enough, but sometimes the market signals are not quick enough. So we should and they may not cover everything, so we should introduce interventions into the market and put a price on the environment so that we more quickly can steer the economy towards sustainability. So on the third step then is the ecological economics, where people say that, well, it's good to put a price on the environment, but it doesn't ensure that you save resources because someone might be ready to pay the high price and then you would still consume it. So they want to combine pricing the environment with absolute boundaries, like quotas or consumption quotas or emission quotas. And then someone would say, oh, that sounds a bit like communism, or that sounds a bit like, is that really possible? But actually we are doing it already. We have the Kyoto Protocol, for example, which is absolute quotas of emissions that are traded under that roof. And then you make the roof smaller as you go along. So that's a typical example of ecological economics.
Is that a thing that deviates from a clean market, or is that actually fully costing the market, bringing in the externalities and so on?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, even I studied some of Adam Smith's book, Wealth of Nations, and actually he's much more diverse and how to say, intuitive than many current economists are. So even a few hundred years ago, he put a lot of restrictions around when a market will work. And it's very rare that we have an ideal market, and there are so many potential market failures. And I would say that, of course, when you put a price on environment that is otherwise not into the economic system, then you are actually making the market work. So when you put a price on externalities and make them internal into the economy, then you're making the economy better at dealing with the market mechanisms and so on. But the point of ecological economics is that sometimes not even that is enough, because some resources might risk being overused anyway, because we might still consume them but at a higher cost. That is the slight nuance there.
Do the principles, the strategic sustainable development principles, did I get it right that time? Do they have anything to say about growth?
Actually, they are neutral to that, I would say, because as long as what they are sort of, if you have a process or a company and you are acting in that company in a way that doesn't violate the principles, meaning that you are growing things in a way that you don't emit into nature, maybe you have recyclable processes and so on, closed loops, more or less, then you can still have economic growth, even expand your business model. So, but we need to start to think in a more, I say, nuanced way about what growth is, because sometimes growth today is just expanding a quite wasteful business model, where we waste a lot of resources, and then you expand that, then you waste even more resources. But if you transition into a business model that wastes less resources, then you can have economic growth while not wasting as much. Still, I would say that it's often difficult to achieve that in practice. To have both growth and the constraints with without systematically erode the environment. And sometimes we talk about development rather than growth. Like, you can have growth in, if you change what you want to. I mean, we often talk about need fulfillment. Like, for example, I like to dance tango, and that gives me a lot of satisfaction in my life. And that's a very low resource demand. And you just need to maybe even bike there, and you go there and you dance, and you even maybe you can even skip the gym the next day, and then you have a lot of social sustainability happening. On the other hand, if you want the same kind of need fulfillment from, for example, going to the next town with the car to a theater or something, or I mean, so there are different ways to fulfill needs that are but could fulfill them equally well, but they wouldn't show up in our current economic systems as needful, as positive things necessarily, because we're only counting how much GDP or money that is circulating.
You said earlier on that sometimes being good enough is enough. I can't exactly remember what context it was in. But I wondered if, in the sustainability field, if we need more than that.
You mean the minimum requirements of sustainability?
Mm.
Yeah, actually a colleague of mine, his name is David Waldron, he was here helping us starting the master's program that we have here. He's working now with, I don't know the exact term, but it's about restorative systems. So rather than just looking at stopping the destruction, which is needed, of course, and that's what we focus on, they have taken one step further and talking about systems that can start to improve themselves again. So you can install, the idea is to look at how nature is doing it, and in some cases you have a natural system that has been eroded or destroyed, it doesn't work as it should. But if you restore some of the water flows and some other things, it starts to regrow again. So that's restorative, is sometimes coming. I think it's necessary because we have destroyed a lot of things, and even if we are not destroying on the margin, we still need to have some places that are really improving. So just enough is not enough.
What motivates you to do this work?
Like I said, I had some realizations when I was very young that I was thinking about how exhaust fumes from cars, where did they go, and so on, and a lot of realizations that this is not going to work the way we do it. So just being able to be part of a solution rather than just looking at the problem is one thing. And then, of course, I also am quite curious, and I like solving problems, and I like simplifying, explaining, and finding good solutions. And here is like the biggest, most interesting problem we have. So why not?
How much does it frustrate you that a whole pile of people don't even think it's a problem?
Sometimes it frustrates me a lot. But I'm so focused on solving some problems most of the time. So I focus on that. And I think we also live in a little bubble, we who work with sustainability. We work with other people who are also contributing. So it's like a quite positive community, even though we are frustrated, of course, that not more is happening. But
we talked about tipping points before and what it's going to take to start the 1,000 days on the electric car ticking along. How big a bubble of people do we need to reach a tipping point?
I actually heard a figure on that. I think it's called the amoeba theory. You know, the I think I pronounce it right.
That's right.
Yeah. And basically an amoeba, it moves. At first it starts to slowly build up attention, and then suddenly it shifts like this. And the first part of this before the shift is that some part of the amoeba is sort of dripping out in the direction. And that's like the early 10% or something, 5 to 10%. And then when enough of those, because the first ones, they're just goofs. People don't think they think they are crazy, basically. They don't understand what they're talking about. But when the thought leaders, the idols, the movie stars, the people who people look up to, when they start to move, then it probably goes much more quickly. So people talk about like 10% or something.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
That depends what you mean by activist, because I don't generally go around telling people what they should do, even though I'm not a fundamentalist in the way that I do everything right always myself. I try to make the big things right, and realizing that sometimes you need to make compromises. But I am very, how to say, I am through my core very, motivated and interested in this area, and that is there. But I try to be pragmatic.
What challenges are you looking forward to in the next year or so?
The first obvious challenge is to run this big project into its destination. and that roadmap is very exciting. It's also something very exciting that I've been looking forward to for a long time. And one of the aims of even starting that big project was to be able to make a big system dynamics study on, in this case now, electric mobility and how to make that more sustainable.
So you're building a systems
model
of the region?
Yeah, you could say that we model how an electric mobility system would compete against an oil-based system, for example, and then how we can try to find those good transition points where we should move into the electric system and other sustainable systems.
Is that model on a whiteboard or in code?
It starts on a whiteboard and then it's a code. So we try to also, and I'm quite excited, I have software now that I can make simulators that we can put on the web. So maybe in a year, people could simulate their systems using our tools.
Cool. If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur tomorrow morning when you wake up, what would it be?
Okay, that's a huge question. I think we have all the technology we need, so that's not needed. But it's a lot about maybe we could have a sudden global awareness and realization that one, we need to change to become sustainable, and two, this is what we need to do. This is how we should do it. I realize it doesn't happen like that, but
I did say miracle.
Yeah.
And lastly, do you have any advice for listeners?
I think do not despair, because I think most of us are quite aware that there is something wrong with the world today. But most of us are also quite frustrated that we don't know what to do to fix it. But there are many things you can do and try to. Now we have the good gift of internet as well, so you can Google and start to find different solutions. And even you could start to generate your own energy, for example, and save your energy bill and start helping the world.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, except when I run away, and me, Samuel Mann. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. On sustainablelens.org, we're building up a searchable archive of conversations with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Today's sustainable lens has been from Dr. Henrik Nye, BTH, in Karlskrona, in Sweden. You can follow the links to sustainablelens.org to find us on Facebook, to keep in touch, and you can listen to Sustainable Lens via iTunes as well. That was Samuel Mann? No, that was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann, and I hope you enjoyed the show.